Hello and welcome to the Medical Women Podcast, the world's first podcast aimed at supporting and empowering medical women in their careers. I'm Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram, and it's my honour and joy to be your host as each week we speak to a fantastic guest who's here to help us in our careers. I'm Vice President of the Medical Women's Federation, the largest body of women doctors in the UK, and the voice of medical women on medical issues. Join us as each week we hear about a topic that's helpful for all of us in our careers. Hello, everybody. I hope that you're all doing well. We were going to start releasing season 4 of the podcast, but a slight change of plans this week. I wanted to do a recast of this episode with Dr. Anthea Mowat, who was our honorary secretary at the Medical Women's Federation until she had to step down in January this year due to ill health. And unfortunately, Anthea passed away this weekend. So in her memory, I wanted to re-release this episode so that people could hear again from Anthea and about Anthea. Anthea came on the podcast to share her wisdom about her career and also to give us some tips on negotiation. Anthea played a huge role as an SAS doctor. Throughout her life, she was involved with being on various committees, being excellent at organizing things. She was invited to organize lots of things, and she was part of the BMA SAS committee and the annual representatives meeting at the BMA, and she was chair of that meeting for several years. She was then headhunted to become honorary secretary of the Medical Women's Federation, and she was amazing in that post, updating all of the processes of MWF, making sure that everything was in good shape and in working order. Her knowledge of bylaws and all the different things that we needed were just astounding and incredibly impressive. And she was one of the kindest people that I've ever had the honor of knowing. She really went out of her way every time we had a new officer or a new member of our office staff join the Medical Women's Federation. Anthea really went out of her way to look after them and make sure that they were looking after themselves, that they were part of the team, that things that we were doing were inclusive. It's been a really tough few months without having Anthea on the officer team. She would kind of very quietly and in a very unassuming way do so many things for MWF. The organization really is indebted to Anthea. And the last few months without having her on the team and not having an honorary secretary, we have really missed her. And lots of times there's things where, you know, we've needed to look something up and we think, oh, Anthea would know this in like 2 seconds, but we have no idea, so we need to go and trawl through this paperwork and try and find it. And just with everything, like whenever we wrote to people or you know, like wrote consultations and things, she would proofread them and just make everything, every process, she made it so seamless. We've really, really missed having her on the officer team the last few months. And I know that she will be incredibly missed by lots of our MWF members, as well as the wider community. When we put out a statement about Anthea's passing, the comments, if you see that people have made on there, you can tell how much she meant to so many people. And everybody has said, you know, the same things, that she's incredibly kind, a gem of a person, always willing to help, very, very gentle, unassuming, very modest, but incredibly capable, incredibly intelligent. She was a huge advocate for SAS doctors and women in medicine and for inclusivity and making things better for everyone. I feel really, really lucky that I got to know her, and I'm really glad that I got to work with her through the Medical Women's Federation. It's been a really sad week for all of us, and we'll all really miss Anthea. But I hope that this episode will be one way of us all reflecting back and remembering how special Anthea was as our colleague and our friend. We're also going to be putting together a special article about Anthea in tribute to her for Medical Woman magazine, which is our MWF magazine that gets sent out electronically to all of our members. So if anybody would like to contribute to that article, please do get in touch. And as you know, you can write as much or as little as you'd like. We'd be really happy to include that in there. So I hope you enjoy this episode in loving memory of our friend and colleague, Dr. Anthea Mowat.
So I'm very excited today to be joined by our wonderful Honorary Secretary, Dr. Anthea Mowat. Hello, Anthea. It's lovely to have you on the podcast.
Hello, Nuthana. Thank you very much for asking me.
So, Anthea, I wonder if we could start by just hearing a little bit about you and your career.
Well, I've had what you might call an alternative career pathway, and that's one of the reasons I'm pleased to be asked to speak on the podcast. For most of my career, I've been an associate specialist, which is a grade that's classed within the SAS grades, the staff and associate specialist grades. But it hasn't been a straightforward journey. I trained in Aberdeen, and I was training as an anaesthetist when my mother became quite unwell. So I actually took a career break and left medicine altogether for 4 years to look after her, and took the opportunity to have children at the same time. And then when my mother died, I went back to work. But that proved to be quite challenging, because I was by then 2 children under 2, a husband who is a GP on a 1 in 2 rota, and a 4-hour round trip to the nearest teaching hospital. So
Wow.
how on earth was I going to manage to have a career? And family was very important, so I didn't want to just abandon them and go off and do more
Yes, of
training.
course.
So I actually took a role as a Married Doctors Retainer Scheme post, which allowed you to do 2 half days a week to start getting back into the NHS and getting your skills back. I think I was only the second hospital doctor ever to do that, because it was usually used for general practitioners returning to work.
Okay.
And it was supposed to be till I was 55, but having done it for 2 years, the postgraduate dean said, "No, I'm not approving you to carry on doing this anymore. You either have to go back into training or you have to find something else to do." And training for me was not an option because of family commitments and husband still being on his 1 in 2 rota. So I looked around and saw that a new job called a staff grade had been introduced. And that seemed to me an ideal way of being able to combine career and having family life, because it was local geographically. And so I applied for that and got it. And I'm been forever grateful to United Lincolnshire Hospitals Trust for allowing me to join them. And they have been supported through the whole of my career. So I was a staff grade for a few years and then got regraded as an associate specialist. But I also developed my medico-political views and commitments during that time. So I had always represented junior doctors, even as a trainee on the junior staff committee. But when I was working as a staff grade, a new thing called a local negotiating committee was invented to allow doctors to have a negotiating platform with management. And we had a very far-sighted medical director who invited me to become the staff grade rep on that. So I did so, and that was really interesting because you found out the issues locally within the hospital, but also the issues that affected other grades. So I served on that for many years and eventually was elected as chair of the local negotiating committee for the whole trust. And it's a big countywide trust with four hospitals belonging to it. And I'm told I was the first SAS grade ever to become an LNC chair, although there were a few followed me fairly quickly after that. And in parallel with that, I also went along to my local BMA division because there was a letter came around to say the division was going to close. So I went to a meeting to find out all about it and came home as the chair of the division.
Oh, wow.
So started doing local representation work. And that was a sort of geographic group of all doctors. So again, it's not just looking at the grade that I was in. It was looking at the issues affecting all doctors and medical students. That then allowed me to go to the BMA annual representative meeting, which is the main policy meeting of the BMA, attended by over 500 people. And I went as a divisional rep representing the geographic group. But I did feel very strongly about some of the issues being discussed that were about SAS grades. And I'll cover the issues with the grade later on, if I may. Mm-hmm. So from there, I was then invited to stand for election to the newly formed SAS committee and got elected and became within a year their deputy conference chair, then their chair. And from there, carried on representing not only local doctors geographically, but also nationally. And I loved how the policy making worked. So I was eventually elected as deputy chair and then chair of the representative body of the BMA, which means that I ran the whole meeting to do the policy setting. It took a few years to get to that position, but you know it was an opportunity that I was given and thoroughly enjoyed doing. And it meant I became one of the chief officers of the BMA and only the first SAS grade and the second woman since 1832 and 25
wow,
years since
go
the
on,
previous
Thea.
Woman. But I'm very pleased to say that my two successors have both been women. So we are getting there. And that allowed me to explore other interests. So I was lead for equality, diversity and inclusion. I was lead for workforce and training. And I changed how the BMA ran their equality and diversity committee. So rather than just having representatives from all the little committees, I got together people who were interested and who had lived experience of issues and also brought in external people. So the reports that came out while I led that were about homophobia in the NHS and a big project about bullying and harassment within the NHS. So that was something that I felt quite passionately about and was very pleased to have the opportunity to do something about. Alongside all of this, in my trust, they also encouraged me to develop. So I did some management and leadership courses through the trust and became one of the first SAS tutors when that role came out. And then later on in my career, became lead appraiser for the whole trust till it led up to my retirement. And I retired and COVID hit, so I went back to work. But I went back in a different role. I went back as a medical examiner and so had to train, doing the training through the College of Pathologists to undertake that role and was very pleased to help the trust out with that. But I now have moved house and I have retired properly from doing anything clinical. Once I'd finished my BMA work, I was then approached to say, would I get involved with Medical Women's Federation? So became their honorary secretary, as you kindly mentioned. But for the last 9 months, I've also been interim chair of the associate members of the World Medical Association, because very sadly, the chair died and the rules meant that they couldn't elect a new chair until a meeting that just happened last week. So I was asked by the WMA to become their interim chair of the associates, which are independent members, and did that for 8 months until we've elected a new chair last week. But apparently I haven't escaped because I'm still classed as past chair for the next 2 years. So I'll still be involved.
You'll still be kept busy.
So a whistle-stop tour of things I've done. I'm not doing that to be self-aggrandizing. It's more to show that there are opportunities that you can take in an alternative career pathway role.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Anthea, because it is really helpful to hear about all the different things that you can do. You've given me so much there. There are so many different avenues we could explore in this podcast now. My favourite part of all of that was, I went to the meeting to find out about it and came back as the chair. That's absolutely brilliant. I can imagine that happening. But we're very lucky to have Anthea as our honorary secretary because she has had all of this involvement with the BMA and various other things that that she knows all the statutes and bylaws. So we don't have to look anything up. We can just say, Anthea, what about this? And we get the answer. So it's brilliant. So you mentioned there about specialist associates being part of the SAS doctors.
Yes.
So if you can just explain to our listeners, what are SAS doctors? Because I don't feel like we actually hear that much about this option school or as a trainee.
We have been quite invisible for many years. They've actually existed since the NHS started and had various different names. At the time I joined them, we were known as non-consultant, non-career grades, and it was a very negative thing and rather a forgotten grade that you were there for service and you didn't get any chance of developing. You were sort of last in the list to be able to get approval for study leave or any CPD you wanted to do. And I felt quite strongly about that. So that was when I started making waves quietly about the grade itself. And luckily, the government also agreed that non-consultant, non-training grades wasn't an appropriate term. It's a very negative thing. So we started being called SAS grades, which stood for staff grades and associate specialists. Although there were other grades that still existed that were in that sort of group known as SAS grades. We called ourselves a forgotten tribe for a bit and then became more obvious and people became slightly more aware. But there is another cohort now, a group of doctors who are employed on local contracts that are called locally employed doctors. Mm-hmm. And that's a group that I think we also need to consider. But if you put the numbers together for SAS grade and the locally employed doctors, there are over 100,000 working in the NHS. And there are only 70,000 trainees, and SAS and LED doctors make up something like 30% of the workforce within the NHS. And yet, as you said, if you ask most students or trainees, they won't know what an SAS doctor is. I was appointed as a staff grade first and then an associate specialist, but we really needed to have the national contracts improved. So I was part of SAS at the time that SAS committee of the BMA at the time that new contracts came out in 2008. And there were some good things and some bad things about that. It gave a much more regulated timetable because we started working in programmed activities like consultants did in 4-hourly blocks of time. But it also allowed a minimum of 1 4-hourly block of time a week called a supporting professional activity to give you time to get involved with audit, do revalidation, do any mandatory training that was required. It should have been more than that, in my view, but at least it was a start and we got something. But sadly, the price for that was closing the associate specialist grade and closing the staff grade. So what we had then was the only grade you could appoint to on national contracts was something called specialty doctor. Mm-hmm. And for that, you needed a minimum of 4 years since graduation with 2 years in the specialty that you wish to join. So there were strict entry criteria. And I think that's why some doctors end up in the locally employed doctor route, because they don't meet the criteria for specialty doctor, but they are working alongside and really should be included within that. And there should be a mechanism for allowing LED doctors to move on to national terms and conditions rather than just having a local contract. But then that then sort of left you with a grade that didn't really have much of a career progression. So you could do CPD, and there was lots of encouragement coming out with various documents for SAS doctors to get involved in education, in mentoring, in leadership. But because we were still rather invisible, we tended to not be appointed to those roles, to be missed off from adverts for opportunities, to be missed out from the list of doctors when you're applying to go on courses. We were either other or we just didn't exist at all. And it really was very frustrating. Mm-hmm. So various documents came out, and I was involved in writing several of them to try and make it a better career for SAS doctors. But there was still this problem of you couldn't progress to a more senior grade without either going back into training or without going through something called a Certificate of Equivalent to Specialist Registration, a CESA route, which mm-hmm. is very complicated and quite expensive. So luckily, there is another new contract out now since 2021, which is called the Specialist Doctor. And that is for a doctor who has got at least 12 years experience, or 12 years since graduation, at least 6 years experience in the specialty, and meets the standards of generic framework that has been written. So there is now an opportunity to progress within the grade to a more senior one, but it really is very, very slow. And I think employers are not bothering to consider that their specialty doctors should be regraded and should be valued and should become specialist doctors instead. And that's part of the problem of the SAS grade. It can be very positive. There are lots of reasons for going into it. It might be family reasons. It may be that you want a portfolio career because you want to do something else. Opportunity to get experience, more time to study for exams, geographic stability at an earlier stage in your career than you might get if you're a trainee and having to rotate a lot. Flexibility in working, but also maybe the fixed bit of working as well. So when I went back to work as a staff grade, the reason it worked for me is I had a fixed night on call, which was the night that my husband wasn't on duty. It was his day off. So for me, having a fixed pattern worked as an SAS grade, but others like it because they can negotiate job plans that are more flexible. But the difficulties with it are lack of support, because you're not seen as a training grade and you're not seen as a consultant. Unawareness, not being considered by omission rather than a deliberate act of omitting people when things are being considered. And a lack of recognition that SAS doctors are perfectly capable of doing the wider roles in education and in management. I know several SAS doctors who are clinical directors, associate medical directors, dean of medical schools. Lots are involved in appraisal in education. When I became SAS tutor, I took the opportunity of using something called SAS Career Development Funding, which is available, and used that to fund a master's in medical education. And that was really useful for the role as being tutor and for carrying on doing the teaching of trainees and students that I was doing in my work. So that there are opportunities and there are lots of things that people can do. But I think the system in general needs to do more to recognise what SAS grades are.
Yeah, and as you've said, 30% of the workforce, it's not at all fair to be omitting or forgetting that that they're there. And I mean, has it improved, or is it still? Do you feel that there's still a lot more?
It is improving. Certainly improving. I'd like to think I was one of the trailblazers, but there are some amazing SAS doctors coming through now who are very vocal within their colleges, within their specialist associations, within their trusts, And there's a new role come out called SAS Advocate, which came as part of the new contract reviews in 2021. Not many have been appointed yet, but I think that's a great opportunity for employers to appoint SAS advocates and encourage not only people to join the role, because it can be a very rewarding alternative career pathway, but also to value and retain those that are in the role. Then there are various other documents about the BMA made some SAS charters, and there's one for each of the nations in the UK. Health Education England made a document about maximising potential, and NHS employers did SAS development guides, which have been updated. And I was very grateful to be involved in the production of all of those documents. But there are other areas where you can get advice. I also was involved with the Association of Anaesthetists SAS Committee for many years, and they have written a very good SAS guidance document, which covers not just, you know, job planning, but covers revalidation. It covers what to do if there's a complaint, you know, how to get involved in research, looking at financial things, looking at pensions. Mm. So it's a great advice source for SAS doctors. But I think a lot of people don't know about it, because SAS doctors tend to be appointed often from international graduates, and they're not given the information and not given the guidance. And employers have been a bit slow about taking on some of the messages within these documents. It's actually an equality issue being an SAS doctor as well. There are more women in the SAS grades than there are in others. There's okay. something like 46% of specialty doctors are women, compared with 39% of consultants. And it's an issue for international graduates. If you look mm-hmm. at ethnic minority groups, 65% of specialty doctors are from an ethnic minority group against 42% of consultants.
Okay.
So we need to be looking and making sure we develop SAS grades
yeah.
and retaining them and valuing them, because it's an equality issue as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, something that I think would be helpful for listeners is a lot of what I've said is kind of maybe it's that systems are set up in such a way that it's omitting and not valuing like quite a significant proportion of the workforce. But as individuals, I think, you know, a lot of the time we sort of think, oh, well, it's a system issue and I can't really do anything about it. And yes, that's true that it's a system issue. But I think as individuals, we can still go and make changes, and definitely what I'd want to advocate for. So what things as individuals can we do to support our colleagues that are SAS doctors?
I think we can all do something by recognising that SAS grade is just an alternative career pathway. It's not because you are a failed anything. Mm-hmm. It's just a different choice. So individual doctors need to get to know their SAS grades. You know, what do they want to do?
So we've spoken a bit there about how, you know, in some ways it's systems that are resulting in us kind of not valuing and forgetting quite a significant proportion of the workforce. But I'm quite keen for us as individuals to feel that we can still do something to support our colleagues, rather than feeling that, oh, well, it's a system issue, so I as an individual can't do anything. So what can we as individual doctors do to support our SAS colleagues?
I think it's important that we recognise that they are equally valued colleagues, and not say, oh, it's just the SAS grades or the locally employed doctors. Very important that people get encouragement. And I think it's important that individual employers and HR departments make sure that SAS doctors are aware of all the advice and guidance that's around, so that they can arm themselves when they do want to do something. From point of view of individuals, if you see somebody has a talent, then encourage them. If they may not be able to do something at the time, but just feeling valued. And, you know, silly things like having a desk, having a locker. They're not silly things, they're important things. But, you know, the basics for people's well-being and making people feel valued. From point of view of organisations, it's remembering that SAS doctors exist and including the grades in drop-down lists if you're applying for conferences or courses. That's something that's a real bugbear for SAS grades. And to view it as a positive thing. But for the individual SAS doctors themselves, I think it's important that you look for and take opportunities. People aren't going to come and hand you things on a plate. But if you are given the option of applying for something, then don't think, well, why me? Don't let your imposter syndrome get in the way. Think, well, why not me? You know, why can't I do it? And apply for it. But I think for me, it's been some quiet persistence that if I haven't got something that I wanted for myself or for my grade, then I've either found a different avenue to use skills that I had, or I've just waited and then brought it back again a bit later. And I haven't gone and sort of shouted at people. I've just been quietly persistent, but brought issues back again and say, look, actually, this is an issue and it's still a problem. And I certainly found when I was chair of the LNC, that worked very well. And we made lots of changes. But I think for individuals, both in the SAS grades and those around them, it's recognizing what the opportunities are. Are there leadership management skills? You know, could they be a rota coordinator? Can they organise audit meetings? Can they organise who presents at audit meetings or at MDTs? An educational role. SAS doctors can be educational supervisors and clinical supervisors. They can be appraisers. They can be representation roles, whether it be locally, regionally, nationally. There are specialist committees. Remember to do your CPD and remember that there are career pots of money for SAS grades that you can apply to help gain skills and further your career. And if you ask to do something and you can't do it at the time, don't be negative and just say, no, I can't do it. Say something like, I would be really interested in that. At the current time, I can't do it because, but please, you know, think of me in the future, so that you're being more positive about not being able to do something if you can't for, you know, family reasons or practical reasons.
Thank you. I think that's really helpful for all of us, regardless of, you know, what title we have. I hope that, you know, we're recording this just after SAS week last week. And I hope that I saw lots of things all over social media about it. So I hope that will be a way of kind of just engaging more people and making more people aware of, you know, 30% of the workforce that are SAS doctors.
Yes, it was the first SAS week, and I hope it's the first of many annual ones. I was delighted how much information there was out on social media and within trusts. And the reason I'm talking about trusts is SAS grades don't exist in general practice. They are hospital-based or community-based. So that's why I've sort of focused on trust employers when I've been mentioning them. It was great to see colleagues that I've met and new SAS doctors that I've not met in person, but become very aware of on social media. And I think there are so many dynamic SAS grades coming through that will be a great future for the grade. It's been slow progression to get to where we are now, but things are improving. But I'm going to pinch a phrase from Rob Fleming, who's a very vocal SAS doctor, that we need parity of esteem for the grade and to allow people to develop and to have a satisfying career, because you're much more likely to retain staff. And I think it's very important to recognise that there are many senior people within the specialty doctor grade who should be regraded as specialist doctors now. And I worry that employers may not do so because they think, oh, it's going to be really expensive. It's not that much of a jump in terms of financial cost, but it's a huge leap for the individual doctor in terms of recognition and being valued. And you're much more likely to retain the staff. Otherwise, they'll walk and they'll go elsewhere because they are very much in demand.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I can imagine. And I think, you know, thinking about my sort of rota at the moment, I think there's far more locally employed
doctors on it than that are in kind of senior clinical fellow posts compared with trainees. So the trust very much relies on them and they're excellent. And actually thinking about it from, you know, what you were saying, it would fit very much with what you had said in that a lot of them are international medical graduates. There are more women. So I'm definitely going to be going and speaking to them about, oh, there are pots of money. You should look into courses that you might want to do, because it might be that they don't know. And as you say, we should be all encouraging everybody's career development.
Well, I think if locally employed doctors are a permanent part of the department, they should be moved on to national terms and conditions. Mm. And that then gives them access to the SAS career development funding. There are some locally employed doctors who are doing it post CCT for experience, and that's always going to be a finite thing before they then move on. But for those who are going to be in those roles long term, then really they should be recognised as and put onto national terms and conditions.
Yep, absolutely. Well, this has been really helpful because I think, as I'd said, I don't really think we get told about this different career pathway. I think a lot of the time in medical school or when you're a foundation doctor or a junior trainee, it's this is the treadmill and this is the only way that you'll get there and get on the training pathway and then you stay on this treadmill and that's it. So I think it is really helpful to hear about different things that you've done and that there are different options because, you know, people like we're humans and life happens and we might need to do things in a different way and that's fine.
Yeah. And it's a good way to have an alternative way of having a good career within medicine. And I was lucky that my employer always did seem to value me. And I have taken opportunities as they've been offered. Even if I thought, oh, I don't think I can do that role, just say yes. You know, you'll learn the skills as you do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I could just talk to you about so many things that, you know, when you first spoke about various things. I wonder, Anthea, you were saying about kind of getting involved with negotiation, and I appreciate that that is a huge topic, could do a whole episode on that in itself. But I wonder if you could give us a few tips as an introduction and things we should think about when we are going to negotiate things.
I think know who you're negotiating with and work out what they want. If you know what they want and you know what you want, you're much more likely to find maybe a middle way that will keep both parties happy. So you do need to look for, is there any wriggle room that would allow you to not compromise what you want, but still end up not in a confrontational way. There are different styles of negotiating, and if it's something like a national contract, you'll have a whole team of people with different skills. You'll have the detail people, you'll have the people watchers, you'll have the note takers. But as an individual, you do need to think about what you want, marshal your arguments for why you have what you want, and you do need to have a sort of bottom line beyond which you will not compromise. And so, you know, have some wriggle room, but have a bottom line. And it may be that will involve leaving your job if you're not getting the recognition that you want. And I do know of several senior SAS doctors who have moved trusts because they weren't feeling valued where they were. And they've moved to other trusts relatively near geographically and are just having a complete different experience of being valued. When I took on the chief officer of the BMA role, it did involve 3 days a week in London. Mm-hmm. And so I had to ask to go part time. And I was a bit worried that the trust would say, no, you can't go part time. So I had actually written a resignation letter so that if they said, no, you can't go part time, then it was, well, I'm off. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do this BMA role. But I was further through in my career. So, you know, it wasn't as if I had young children at that point. They were much older. The trust agreed to me going part-time, but at that point I was doing both anaesthesia and chronic pain management. So they did ask if I would keep on the chronic pain management in the part-time role and stop doing anaesthesia. So that was my compromise to be able to do that role, was that I gave up doing general anaesthesia, but I carried on doing the chronic pain management work because that would fit in the 2 days a week. So the trust got the service to continue because there were only three of us who were doing that particular part of the service. I got to go part time, and so we'd sort of compromised, but we'd come to a mutually acceptable arrangement. So I think that worked reasonably well.
Yes. Yeah, that's really helpful. Think about what they want and what you want, and yeah, what your bottom line would be for compromising. I think that's a very helpful whistle top in store of negotiation. So thank you, Anthea. I am going to move on to our quick fire questions now, if that's okay. So I was saying to Anthea before we started recording that maybe I should change these because if guests are listeners, they come armed with answers already because they already know what questions I'll ask. But I won't do that. I will keep the questions the same because our listeners have said, no, please keep these questions. We really like listening to the answers. So the first question is, if there was a book or several books you could recommend, what would they be?
Well, I'm going to mention two books. I've recently been at my university class's 40-year reunion, and we have two authors among our group.
Wow.
So the two books I'm going to recommend are Love Until It Hurts by Fiona Blakemore, and another one called Miles Away by N.J. Edmonds. I've read one, I'm halfway through the other one. And they're very good novels, psychological novels. But I'm just so proud that, you know, these are my classmate colleagues that are now published authors. So that's why I'm going to mention those two.
Great. Well, that's great reasons to mention those books. I think from now on, when I ask this question, I'm going to have to bring all of my books and say, please choose books from this pile, because otherwise I'm just buying more and more books at a faster rate than I can actually read through them. But those books both sound really interesting. My next quickfire question is there something you know now that you wish you had known earlier on in your career?
I think possibly, having said to take opportunities, you don't have to say yes to everything. You can say no to some things politely. But I think the key for me is get your priorities right. Know what your priorities are for you. And they're different for everybody. And be true to that. And treat others as you would wish to be treated. I mean, I've always tried to do that. But I think they would be my main points to highlight from my seems like huge long experience, but I'm not that old.
No, and you don't look like you've been at your 40th reunion from med school either. So we don't think you're old, Anthea. But I think that's very helpful advice, because, you know, a lot of the time, and I've certainly kind of ended up sort of burning myself out saying yes to so many things, because you feel like, oh, well, I'm so grateful that they've asked me and they've given me this opportunity. But sometimes just thinking, well, if I am going to do that thing, where is the time for that going to come from?
Yeah.
And just saying, okay, well, if you want me to do this thing, then what about this other thing that I'm doing? Do you still want me to do that as well? So I think that is helpful, because we do only have 24 hours and we do actually need to sleep and look after ourselves as well as doing everything else. My next question is about advice. So is there any advice that you've ever been given that's been really helpful that you would want to share with others?
I think probably to look after yourself. And while we are all keen to get involved in doing things, nobody's indispensable. And so if you feel you can't do something or you want to stop doing something, that's all right, if it's the right thing for you. So look after your health and your well-being. I think that's really important.
Yeah, thank you. And I think kind of with the way that the whole NHS runs, we all end up being martyrs, don't we? And we're sort of, I think we just kind of perpetuate that as well. So I think if we start kind of looking after ourselves and modeling to our colleagues that, you know, we need to look after ourselves, then that's really important. Like when I'm on nights and it gets to 4 o'clock in the morning, I just saying I can't think, I just need 5 minutes to have a break and just sit down, and then I'll actually be able to function when I get back. And and people saying, oh yeah, that's a good idea, I should do that too. I think I've noticed that that is helpful. So thank you for sharing that. Definitely think we all need to look after ourselves. And my last question is a question that I am borrowing from the RCPCH and Us, who are a group of children and young people that work with the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. I'm very grateful that they let me borrow this question because I think it probably is everybody's favourite question. And the other question, as you know, is if you were a type of biscuit, what type of biscuit would you be and why?
I struggled with this because I thought, oh, well, I fancy that sort of biscuit and I like those. I think I've come down to I would be a crispy amaretti biscuit.
Oh, that's a lovely biscuit. Why would you be a crispy amaretti?
Goes well
amaretti
with coffee,
biscuit?
Tastes lovely, not too big. So I think that's what I would plump for.
Lovely. And I really want a biscuit. These are dangerous questions. I'm getting lots of books and biscuits. I think we should set up some sort of MWF shop where people come and read the books and eat biscuits.
I think that's a fabulous idea.
Yeah, that's what we should do. Or maybe at the next conference we can have a session where there's like different biscuits mentioned on the podcast or something.
At conference you could always do a list of the books that people have recommended.
Yes.
For those who haven't heard all of the podcasts.
Yeah, that's true. And yeah, just plates of the different biscuits that people can go and try. I'm getting ideas for our next conference already. Well, thank you so much, Anthea. It's been so lovely having you on the podcast. Is there anything else that you would want to mention to our listeners? Apart from join the Medical Women's Federation, of course.
Definitely join the Medical Women's Federation. But also thank you for listening. And it's not often that SAS grades have an opportunity to highlight the things that we can do. And if it helps you assist your SAS grade colleagues, that would be great.
Yep, absolutely. And 30% of the workforce, you know, that's a really significant amount of our colleagues who we do really value. So making sure that they feel valued and looking after them as well is really important. So thank you for coming and sharing that. I hope that listeners find this episode really helpful. So thank you, Anthea.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to the Medical Women podcast. Make sure to subscribe for free on whichever podcast platform you listen on so that you automatically get our episodes. The aim of this podcast is to support and empower as many medical women in their careers as we possibly can. So please share this episode with at least one other medical woman. If you're interested in joining the Medical Women's Federation, we would love to have you. And all links to our website and social media are in the show notes. This podcast has been produced on behalf of the Medical Women's Federation by Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram and Miss Jenna McKenzie. Our music was composed and played by Dr. Kethaki Bayankaram. Thank you so much for listening.